This is Robert Travis Scott, president of the Public Affairs Research Council of Louisiana. So welcome to the Jim Inkster Show. I'm sitting in for Jim today, and we'll be talking with Scott Rabelais, the sports columnist for The Advocate, known for his colorful prose and sense of humor covering the LSU Tigers and the New Orleans Saints. He'll teach us how to translate the unique language of Coach Les Miles. Also today, our hospitals and our programs for elderly care in Louisiana are facing tremendous financial challenges and great uncertainty about the future. These are problems likely to affect you and many of the people you know. So we'll hear today from Joe Donches, Executive Director of the Louisiana Nursing Home Association, and Paul Salas, President of the Louisiana Hospital Association. They'll have two proposals on the November 4th election ballot that all voters in Louisiana will get to decide. We'll talk about whether you should vote yes or no. We'll cover that and more on the Inkster Show, but first, the news. Welcome back to the Jim Inkster Show. This is Robert Travis Scott, the president of the Public Affairs Research Council of Louisiana. I'm sitting in today for Jim Inkster. Well, we're going to have some fun today. We're going to be talking to Scott Rabelais, the sports columnist for The Advocate. He'll be on in the last segment of our show. Hang around. You can call in and join us at 297-5633. That's area code 225-297-5633. If you want to join and talk to, with folks on the show today, welcome to WRKF 89.3. We have for the first segments of our show in our studio this morning, Mr. Joe Donches, Executive Director of the Louisiana Nursing Home Association, and Paul Salas, President of the Louisiana Hospital Association. These two men are among the most knowledgeable in our state about these issues. You know, we have an amazing healthcare system here in the United States, but at the same time, it's expensive. We have issues with insurance coverage. There's a lot of concerns because all of these issues affect our tax dollars. They affect the health of our loved ones. And so I've invited these two gentlemen in here today to talk about proposals that they have on the November 4th ballot. We have 14 constitutional amendments, but today we're just going to talk about a couple of those and also some of these broader health care issues. Now, we're going to start with Amendment Number 1 and Amendment Number 2 on your ballot. They're going to be Amendment Number 1 and Amendment Number 2. They deal with nursing homes and long-term care and hospitals and the financing for those. And Joe, we're going to start with you and tell us what Amendment Number 1 would do and what exactly is the problem that we're trying to address with that.
Thank you, Robert, for the opportunity to be here today. Constitutional Amendment Number 1 will provide a stable source of funding for our most vulnerable seniors in the state, for many of our developmentally disabled, and for community pharmacies. The good news about this is that this program could be expanded to provide other programs as well. So if a group wants to pay a provider tax in an effort to draw down additional federal funds, they could support legislation that would do that. This constitutional amendment, while providing a stable source of funding, will also ensure that legislators take a very close look at whether they should cut these programs. The legislature would be asked to vote by a two-thirds vote to determine whether these programs should be cut. And lastly, if they are cut, the average cuts would not be great, or the cuts to these programs would not be greater than average cuts across the board. So one of the things that the state did a few years ago was cut the nursing facility program by 16%, didn't cut any other programs that year, but did raid the trust fund for the elderly of $184 million.
Let's go back and ask a question to make sure we understand this, because usually when you think about a tax or an assessment on an industry, usually that industry doesn't want that to happen to them. But here you are saying that actually you want that to happen and that this constitutional amendment will help protect how that money flows. Explain why that would be.
It protects how the money flows, and I'll give you an example. Right now, we have raised in the past 22 years, and I'm talking about the nursing facility program alone, $1.5 billion. That's paid from the nursing facilities to the state. That, in turn, has raised $3.4 billion in federal funds inuring to the benefit of the state Medicaid program.
So basically, the way it works is, You voluntarily and willingly pay a tax because you know you're going to get a federal match that's going to bring more money back to you. At least in theory, that's the way it's supposed to work. More money back to you in the long run. And that's why you would support this type of assessment.
Yes, sir. Up until now, the benefits of this additional federal money were spread throughout the Medicaid program. The senior program saw very little amounts of this. What this will do ensure that any provider group that pays a provider fee will receive the benefits of those federal dollars.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I mean, it's a complicated system, and this particular amendment does not create a new tax or a new assessment. Amendment number one does not create any new assessment. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. It just basically provides these protections for it. Let's go to Paul and Paul Salas with the Hospital Association. And Paul, what is it that amendment number two would do? And what is exactly the problem we're trying to address with that?
Sure. Thanks, Robert. Again, appreciate you having me on as well. Maybe I'd like to start by just providing maybe a little bit more broader background on how we got to this point. I think most folks in communities realize that hospitals are the cornerstones of healthcare services in their communities, provide a wide variety of emergency services, cancer care, pediatric NICU-related care, and increasingly through employment of physicians, evolving into providing a great deal of primary care as well. The concept of a vote for amendment number two is essentially supporting hospitals and their ability to continue to provide these services. We think the public is very aware of the significant cuts to healthcare funding that have occurred over the past several years. And we believe that they support the concept of developing a sustainable system that would restore and protect that funding specifically for hospitals. And that's what, broadly, Amendment number two is designed to accomplish.
Well, and let's make sure we understand the difference. The Amendment number one really addresses nursing homes, long-term care facilities for the disabled, some pharmacies. That's really what we're talking about on existing assessments, not creating a new assessment. Amendment number two is really for the hospitals, and it creates a new assessment, one that doesn't exist now, and it creates a fund to help protect those. And tell us from the hospital's perspective what you expect to get out of being charged an assessment. Hospitals, by and large, not all of them, I guess, but by and large, hospitals want this assessment, right?
Yes, that's correct. And the way I would describe it, I think broadly, maybe the best way of explaining it to the public is essentially what this is a system that allows hospitals in the industry to pool funds in partnership with the state. I think that's really the best conceptual way of thinking about this, in an effort to draw down additional federal dollars, and again, for those specific services in hospitals. So we kind of view this as a system of partnering with the state. Our initial goal is to try to restore some of the cuts that happened to hospitals over the past several years. And a system like this is currently used in about 40 other states across the country to create a more sustainable funding system for hospitals.
All right, we have a caller. Kay in New Iberia, you're on the Jim Inkster Show.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm very interested and concerned about Amendment number one that Mr. Don just spoke about, and that is because I have a son with a developmental disability that relies on home and community-based services to be employed in our community and to live independently. My concern is that if Amendment number one passes, it protects only those institutional providers and puts in jeopardy for more vulnerable to budget cuts when there's a deficit, the home and community-based services. And the real point of that is my son waited 10 years to get those services, and there's still some 45,000 people with developmental disabilities waiting for those services, that the home and community-based services are the choice of first.
Okay,
empty nursing home beds.
Yes.
My question is, how is it fair to protect one group of providers and at the same time put others in jeopardy?
Okay, thanks. Let's let Mr. Donchus answer that question. I think it's a great question. Thank you very much. So hang on, let's get his answer to it.
Thanks for the question, Kay. Quite to the contrary, this will free up additional state general fund dollars. Right now, nursing facilities receive, as part of their payment, only 5% of monies from state general funds. The vast majority of these monies right now come from the Trust Fund for the Elderly and Provider Fee. The typical Medicaid program receives about 37% of their funding from state general dollars. So we believe that it will continue to free up additional state general funds for other programs, such as home and community-based services.
297-5633. You're listening to the Jim Inkster Show. This is Robert Travis Scott sitting in for Jim Inkster today. And you can call us at 225-297-5633 to join the conversation with Joe Donches, Executive Director of the Louisiana Nursing Home Association, and Paul Salas, President of the Louisiana Hospital Association. We're talking about Amendments Number 1 and 2, and on the ballot on November the 4th. And these gentlemen are very knowledgeable about the impact of those amendments. And if you need to learn a little bit more about these, the Public Affairs Research Council does have an amendment guide on its website. I'm going to plug my own organization because I think it's a good guide that's free, and you can it's very independent and unbiased. We don't tell you how to vote. We just give you both sides of the issue, and that's at parlouisiana.org, www.parlouisiana.org. Look for that guide to the amendments. Joe, why is there this tension between home care-based services and nursing homes? I don't think most people realize that there might be some tension there financially in terms of appropriations and money flows for those different types of care.
I wouldn't call it a tension. I would call it a matter of fighting for budgetary dollars that have been really short over the last several years. One of the other things I wanted to mention to Kay, the caller, is that there are 44 states that have a provider tax on nursing facilities, and the majority of those states allow the federal dollars to inure to the benefit of the Medicaid program that's paying for those. So we're no different than the majority of the states that have a provider tax.
Let's go to John in Lafayette on line two. John, welcome to the Jim Inkster Show.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. My question has to do with the dedicated funds. As I understand it, almost everything is now dedicated, all the state money, so that when there's a shortfall, which there is every year, we have another $1 billion shortfall staring us in the face. When there is, the only two things that can be cut are health care and higher education. Now, if these amendments pass, health care will be taken care of. They'll have dedicated funds. And higher education will have no protection at all. So what's going to happen to the universities? Are they going to close? Or what do these men suggest that higher education do?
John, thank you very much. It's a good question, and it's a common question I hear a lot, Paul. What do you say to that?
Thanks, Robert. And John, it's a great question as well. I think our view of this, much like Joe's previous explanation, is that we recognize that the healthcare industry has its set of issues around funding the critical services that are delivered by our hospitals. This solution is really an industry-based solution to, in an attempt to solve some of our own problem. And we believe that, in fact, by allowing this kind of a system to be implemented, that it actually frees up very scarce state resources for other uses. Without a system like this in place, the result is that healthcare, higher education, and all the other services that are delivered by our state are all competing for very scarce resources. We believe a system like this, again, provides some flexibility in that if we can develop a system that solves some of our own funding problems, this sort of scarce resources can be broadly used and offer additional flexibility to our legislature when completing the budget.
Well, we only have a short time before the break, but Joe, you know, in the past, you talked about how the assessments on the nursing homes and these other facilities was like $1.5 billion over the years, and it caused a flow back from the federal government of $3.4 billion. But has all that money come back to those institutions, or has it been spent on other budget priorities?
It's been spent on many other budget priorities within the Medicaid program. It's not outside the department, but it has been spent on, I believe, every other Medicaid program out there, and we only see a very small portion of it.
All right, we'll be right back for the next segment of the Jim Inkster Show. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Jim Inkster Show. Robert Travis Scott here, sitting in for Jim Inkster. I'm the president of the Public Affairs Research Council. You can check our website at www.parlouisiana.org for our guide to the constitutional amendments that will be on the ballot on November 4th. And we've been talking about those two constitutional amendments with Joe Donches, executive director of the Louisiana Nursing Association, and Paul Salas, the president of the Louisiana Hospital Association. And you can join us at 297-5633. That's 225-297-5633. Our long distance 1-877-217-5757 to join the conversation. Gentlemen, this is a very interesting program that a lot of states use. In fact, we are in a minority of states on the hospital fee where we don't use this type of assessment to draw down these Medicaid dollars for the hospitals. The nursing home facilities in the state are in good company with many states across the country that have this type of assessment. It's not an unusual thing. But the question a lot of people have is, why do we need to embed these things and create them in the Constitution as opposed to regular statutes? Because once it's in the state constitution, it's harder to mess with, it's harder to tinker with, it's harder to tweak. Who wants to go first? You, Paul?
Sure, Robert. I'll take a shot at that. We think it's important for this to be in the Constitution. We think implementing a system like this that involves an industry-based solution, we think the insurances that are included in the constitutional amendment both assure the industry and quite maybe even more importantly, assure the public that if a system like this is implemented at some point in time in the future, that those funds are absolutely dedicated to provide those services. So we think it's an important assurance, and that's why we think it needs to be in the Constitution.
Joe, can you add to that?
I agree with him wholeheartedly. You know, our state is going to increase the number of elderly by 40% in the next 16 years. There is going to be a silver tsunami, and what we have to do is prepare for that. And if we can get the protections of the Constitution, then we would very much appreciate that.
Yeah, well, I see between the three of us, there's a little bit of silver hair going on in here. I guess we're part of that tsunami. We're all going to be facing those issues. We have line two, Steve, downtown. Steve, welcome to the Jim Inkster Show.
All right, thanks, Robert. I said a couple of questions. Both your guests have said that these two amendments would provide more flexibility or free up dollars, but it seems to me that if you're putting taxes and if you're putting spending mandates in the Constitution, that you're locking up dollars and taking away that flexibility. I'm certainly a big supporter of hospitals and nursing homes. They're very important for our state, but you know, also I'm worried about what that means for colleges or other health providers, especially with the budget problems facing our state, big shortfalls, the nursing home trust fund is empty. So I just kind of wanted your guests to clarify how exactly it provides more flexibility to put all these decisions in the Constitution. Wouldn't it make more sense for the legislature to make those choices every year?
Well, I think Paul answered this question last time, and Joe, maybe this time you can answer the question, but it's a very similar question.
Well, these aren't truly dedicated monies. The legislature can, by a two-thirds vote, choose to cut these programs. And what our thinking is that this will just give the legislature a little bit more time, maybe a little bit more diligence in making these decisions. But let me comment that only one time in the past 17 years has a budget passed without receiving a two-thirds vote. So the legislature is not shy about cutting programs when it has to, and it could easily get a two-thirds vote to cut either the nursing home program or the ICDD program or the community pharmacies program or the hospital. So this is not truly a dedicated fund.
So you're saying that you could make cuts with a two-thirds vote of the legislature without going back to the people to change the Constitution.
That's
what you're
exactly
saying.
Correct.
That's what this provides. Very interesting. Well, I will tell you, there are 14 amendments on the ballot. This is just number one and two. But I think these are probably two of the most important amendments out there. I would suggest that you go into the booth knowing what these issues are and whether you're going to vote yes or no. We suggest you do your homework first and go in with a little checklist of whether you're going to vote yes or no on these. Now, This is the Jim Inkster Show. I'm Robert Scott with the Public Affairs Research Council, sitting in for Jim today. We're talking to Joe Donches with the Nursing Home Association and Paul Salas with the Hospital Association. You can join the conversation at 297-5633. And we have Nell from Lafayette. Nell, welcome to the Jim Inkster Show.
Hi, thank you for allowing my question. My question is for Mr. Donches, and I'm only addressing Amendment Number 1 in this question. Not just in Louisiana, but nationally, this is an example of the political power of the nursing home industries and other institutional providers that's resulted in a healthcare system that's very heavily biased toward care in facilities instead of care at home. Mr. Donches says he's speaking for the most vulnerable and that there's about to be a silver tsunami. But really, to get into a home care program, that is, not to get round-the-clock care in a nursing home, but just to get somebody to help you out for a few days, I mean, for a few hours a day at home, a person has to meet the same qualifications as they have to meet to get into a nursing home in terms of need for care. And I think Mr. Donches will confirm that. But while we have...
And now your question, tell me if you have a question. This is very interesting, and I think it's a good point. Do you have a question?
Right. Doesn't Mr. Donches acknowledge that there are lengthy waiting lists for people to get care at home, but you could get into a nursing home right now for around-the-clock care with the same level of need? That's my first question.
Okay, let's go with that one. How about it, Joe?
Thank you for the question, Nell. I would encourage any listener out there to go visit a nursing facility and see the conditions of our elderly in these facilities. They have very high acuity levels, and certainly while it is true that people in the community must meet a nursing home standard, these folks are a lot in a much better condition than those folks in nursing facilities. The number of the folks who are ambulatory in nursing facilities now have decreased exponentially over the last 15 years. And the reason for that is because the department has expanded its home and community-based services program. In fact, it is fourth in the South in offering services to people in the community. So I would submit that while the people do have to meet a certain standard to get home and community-based services similar to what people have to meet in nursing facilities, our residents in nursing facilities have much higher acuity levels than those folks living at home.
Thanks, Joe. Again, you're listening to the Jim Inkster Show on WRKF 89.3. Robert Travis Scott sitting in here today for Jim Inkster. We're talking to Paul Salas with the Hospital Association and Joe Donches with the Louisiana Nursing Home Association. Paul, let's turn our attention to the broader big national and state issue that we're facing, and that is the future of what's going to happen to Medicaid and insurance coverage. Now, under Obamacare, many states have signed up for a Medicaid expansion, which basically offers Medicaid coverage, insurance coverage through the government to low-income people. We already have a lot of children covered under Medicaid, but this Obamacare expansion would have expanded it to a lot of adults as well as a number of others. And so that was seen by some people as one of the solutions to the financial issues facing the hospitals, which have to sometimes pick up the cost for treating people who come in for urgent care and who are uninsured or don't have the means to pay their medical bills. Now, a number of states have not gone this route. Louisiana has not gone this route. And we've seen states around the country who have used alternative methods to expand coverage, but do it more in the private industry rather than signing people up for government Medicaid service. So, Paul, your association looking at these broad issues down the road, is coverage expansion something that would be helpful to the hospitals of Louisiana at some point? versus traditional Obamacare expansion, or do y'all have yet a different type of solution to the long-term plan?
Rob, it's a great question. I appreciate it. I think our view of this is that coverage expansion is something that we believe needs to be considered, but we support being very deliberate about this process. I think there are lots of different things, new methods of increasing coverage, as you've mentioned, that many other states are experimenting with. We think that some of the new models do hold a great deal of promise. And I think being deliberate here in Louisiana about customizing a system that utilizes, we believe, a preferred way of utilizing private coverage to do that coverage expansion is certainly better for the state of Louisiana. I think we're supportive of and eager to be involved in a process where we might look at how coverage expansion could be done in a very creative way using the private sector and best meet the needs of the citizens of Louisiana, so customized for us particularly.
Well, we'd be very interested in hearing what sort of customized plans you might suggest for the state of Louisiana. Now, you know, the traditional way of dealing with this in Louisiana was through the publicly owned, the state-owned charity hospital sure. system. But now we've gone through a process where we still have a lot of those institutions, these charity hospitals, but they're now being run by private operators. What has changed? How has that changed your outlook on the financial issues facing hospitals in the state? Has the privatization been that the general administration has brought, has it been a positive things, or is it just a work in progress?
I guess I would characterize it by saying it's a piece of the puzzle. It's not the complete puzzle. So we think that the privatization has had a positive impact in the areas that they've been implemented. I think there have been a number of stories and reports about how services have been increased, waiting times have been decreased, and those things are certainly positive. On the other hand, we've seen instances where other facilities in communities continue to see, and in many cases, an increase in some of the uninsured care being provided in their facilities. So we still have pieces to the puzzle that need to be addressed. This privatization clearly didn't solve all of the issues related to the uninsured care and how it's delivered in Louisiana. So our view is there's still work to do. I think some of the things that we talked about earlier around creatively thinking about how we might do some type of coverage expansion in the future could be another part of the puzzle. I think we're still trying to figure out the complete system and how we address all of the needs of hospitals and services in communities.
Well, Joe, turning to you with the Nursing Home Association, let's just talk about some of the practical issues that people face, because I think we're talking about pretty high-level financial issues here, but all these things really affect us on a personal and family level. What should I be thinking about me, my wife, as we get older and planning and knowing that one day, we may need some type of assisted care? The kids probably don't want to put up with this, but what should we be thinking now, and what sorts of policies should we be keeping an eye on that you think would affect us in the long run as we think about retirement in later years and maybe needing some additional care?
That's a great question, Robert. You know, so many people don't want to think about their care needs for the future. One of the things my wife and I did is sat down when I reached the age of 50 and thought, what should we do to prepare for this? And we went out and studied all of the long-term care policies, and we bought a long-term care policy that includes not only nursing home care, but assisted living care and home health care. So we think we're prepared for the future. A lot of people think that they can't afford a good long-term care policy, but I would encourage them just to look at this like any other budgetary issue. Plan for it, because I'll tell you, more than 5 out of 10 people, if they reach the age of 65, are going to spend some time in a nursing facility. If they want to rely on Medicaid, they can do that. If they want to think about paying privately in an assisted living facility, and there is no Medicaid program in Louisiana for assisted living, or maybe do something that might be a little bit of a higher caliber, then they could have that long-term care policy to back them up with that.
Most people who are in nursing homes, are they on Medicaid? Are they getting
the majority is mm-hmm. on Medicare. It's about 72%.
Medicaid.
72%. Yeah. We have about 12 to 13% of our residents in short-stay Medicare stays. Typically, they're discharged from a hospital. They need some form of therapy. They'll go into a skilled nursing facility, spend about 20 days there, and then discharged home.
Okay. And Medicare really is the insurance, health insurance coverage for the elderly, and Medicaid really helps pay for something like a nursing home facility and paying for those. But do you have to be impoverished to get Medicaid? I mean, I think this is some of the mythology about Medicaid and nursing homes, and maybe you can help clarify a little bit. But I think a lot of people think, well, mom and dad, you know, they're reaching that point. We may have to put them into a nursing home or get some home care, and we're going to have to impoverish them in order to make them eligible for Medicaid. Is that a myth, or is that, how does that work?
The federal government several years ago saw the need to help the elderly spouse still living at home. So they developed what's called the spousal impoverishment program that allows that person living at home to keep income and resources that would typically have to be spent down in order to get into a nursing facility. If you're single, you still have to spend down to $2,000 in resources, but otherwise, if you're a spouse living at home, you get to keep a great deal of that money and use it for your daily needs.
Well, we have just a few minutes left. Here on the Jim Inkster Show, Robert Scott here sitting in for Jim Inkster today with Joe Donches of the Louisiana Nursing Home Association and Paul Silas with the Louisiana Hospital Association. And stay tuned, we'll have Scott Rabelais on for the last segment. He's a sports columnist for The Advocate, and we'll be talking about Les Miles speak to see if we can translate Les Miles. But let's just close out here with some observations about the next legislative session coming up. How do you think Bobby Jindal has done so far in his terms? And is there anything left for him to do before he gets out? Or is it like a lot of us hoping that he does almost nothing before he gets out?
Just again, purely my opinion. I think it's going to be a very light legislative session as compared to previous ones. It is an election year, and we would typically not see a great deal of activity either by the legislature or the administration, given that this is really the final legislative session of his term. Mm-hmm.
And how about you, Joe?
What are the other governor has taken on the serious issues of the charity hospital system? The retirement system in Louisiana, ethics. Governor Jindal has done so much in the past 7 years. I agree with Paul that this last legislative session is probably going to be how not to get involved in any serious issues, because it is an election, will be an election year next year. But otherwise, you know, it's been, I think, a very interesting run for Governor Jindal, and I think he has accomplished a lot.
Yeah, and let's talk about whoever the next governor is going to be. What would be your message to the gubernatorial candidates who will be up for election in 2015? What would you tell them are the one or two things they most need to keep in mind and think about for reform? How about you, Paul?
Sure. I think some of the things that we've talked about earlier, Robert, I think obviously we work in the healthcare industry, and we realize how important the services that we provide in our communities. We realize that we have a great deal of needs, and we have a lot of work to be done in the primary and preventive care area. Hospitals are certainly willing to be part of conversations about how do we improve care, how do we help with cost containment and improving quality.
And Joe, let's let Joe slip in here. What would you say to the next governor?
Louisiana's 42nd in reimbursement for nursing facilities. Keep in mind that with the coming of the Affordable Care Act employer mandate, there's going to be more money needed for these elderly programs, not less.
Many thanks to Joe Donches, Paul Silas, for joining us today. We'll be back with Scott Rabelais with The Advocate, funny sports columnist on the Jim Inkster Show. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Jim Inkster Show. This is Robert Travis Scott, president of the Public Affairs Research Council of Louisiana. I'm sitting in today for Jim Inkster here on WRKF 89.3. We're going to have on with us right now Scott Rabelais, the sports columnist for The Advocate. If you follow his columns, you probably chuckle a lot The way he has a unique way of expressing his observations about the sports events on the big fields in Baton Rouge and in New Orleans. Welcome, Scott.
Good morning, Robert. How are you?
I am doing great. Thanks for joining us. Sure. If you want to call in, folks, today to have a question for Scott Rabelais with The Advocate, that's 297-5633, 297-5633. And join the conversation. Well, Brandon Harris or Anthony Jennings, what's it going to be?
It looks like Brandon Harris is going to be the starter Saturday against Auburn, the freshman. Les Miles, I thought he might keep everyone in suspense all week because Les likes his little mini melodramas. But there was white smoke at his press conference yesterday, and he said that there's going to be a change at the starting quarterback position, much needed. You hate to knock Anthony Jennings because he is a sophomore in college, not a pro like Drew Brees getting paid to play quarterback. But
do you sometimes wonder about that? I mean, when you pick up the paper, and the morning after a game, and you see, Jennings melting down, problem with Jennings, Brandon Harris doing great. Do you ever wonder whether the paper's being a bit severe on these amateur athletes?
Yeah, sometimes you do, but at the same time, this is a big time program. LSU and these kids do know what they're coming in for, and they're coming to LSU because they want to become really have a chance to really go to the NFL and make huge sums of money. So they're coming here for that kind of instruction. So they're used to all the media attention. Anyone who LSU recruits has been through a lot of media scrutiny already because they're through the recruiting process and everything. So, but yeah, at the same time, I don't think they deserve quite the same level of harsh criticism that a pro might deserve, because these guys are truly getting paid a lot of money to play their sport.
Yeah, 297-5633. If you have a question for Scott Rabelais, the sports columnist for The Advocate, I hear they call you Rab at The Advocate. Is that right?
They do. Yes. A little short for something. Of course, you could be trying to talk to my dad or my brother. You'd get the same thing, but yes.
And could we also call you Professor Rabelais? I hear you teach over at LSU. Is that right?
I teach. I'm an instructor. I'm not a professor. My late father-in-law was a sociology professor at UNO in southeastern Louisiana, Dr. Jerry Salamone. He was dean of arts and sciences for a while at Southeastern.
Yeah.
He was a professor.
Just because you're not a professor doesn't mean we can't call you a professor.
Well, I understand.
So we'll call you Professor Rabelais from now on. So what exactly do you teach students about sports writing?
Yeah, I teach a sports writing class, a graduate-level sports writing class this semester, the second time I've taught it. And,
a graduate-level sports writing class?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's a smaller class. You get paid the same amount, but it's a smaller
What do you learn in a graduate-level class that you can't learn in an undergraduate class on sports writing?
You expect them to have a little more knowledge.
Better puns or something?
Yeah. Well, hopefully. But we just had them cover the New Mexico State game last weekend, so I wanted them to kind of be immersed in, what it is like to be a sports writer covering a game, especially on deadline at night.
Right.
And file stories right after the game, stories and videos and columns. And Corey Webster, the former LSU player who was a cornerback for the New York Giants, who is now retired, he's in my class. So that's kind of interesting. He for show and tell, it was like elementary school a little bit.
Well, I guess part of the graduate level course, I guess, is understanding how to speak the language of Les Miles. Now, we're going to pick on Les a little bit. I like Les. I really respect Les. But we're going to pick on him a little bit here because he sometimes says some pretty funny things. And you had an article in the paper just last Saturday where you looked at some of the funny things that he said, and you gave us a good translation for it. Like, for example, I think you'll look forward to seeing more balls in the air as we go forward, and I think there's some spread in our future considering both quarterbacks are mobile. Tell us what that means.
That means that they're going to pass the ball more. There's been a lot of criticism that LSU is too run-oriented, particularly out of a out of a pro set, a I formation with two tight ends and a fullback and a tight end and a running back. People want to see more of a spread out attack with more wide receivers and more passing downfield. So it sounds a little funny, but yeah, you have to kind of read between the lines a little bit of Les. I've been asked to interpret him, around other sports writers before.
Like you call it miles speak, I think.
Miles speak, yeah.
I mean, here's one. This is a quote from Miles. Whatever we, if we need to teach in a different manner, if we need to, if the signaler needs to be more specific to the position, in any event, that's what will get accomplished. So can you help translate that miles speak for us?
Yeah, I think that was the one I was like, I'm not exactly sure.
can't get there.
Even once in a while, you go to the well, once too often, unfortunately, with Les. But I've never met anyone, I certainly never covered anyone who constructs their sentences the way Les Miles does.
Well, let me ask you this. You have some tight deadlines. I'd just like to hear, folks would like to hear what it's like being a sports reporter up in the press box when a game's going on. And, of course, you're doing not only some reporting but analysis and perspective and sort of color commentary on what's going on. But while a game is going on, are you writing during the game going on? And how do you get things in on deadline when it's a night game?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to write during the game to get done, and our deadlines have gotten progressively tighter over the years. Even though we have more technology now, going back to the days of when people used typewriters and Western Union to send their stories in, they had a couple of hours. But at this point, with us having a New Orleans edition now and an Acadiana edition that we're trying to improve, they need these things for those editions so they can start getting those papers rolling right at the end of the game. So we had to file stories, not just myself, but a couple of the other sports writers had to file right as the game ended. And at the Saints game Sunday night, we had 30 minutes after the game. But you are writing during the game, and you just have to kind of take a tack, and say, I'm going this way with it. And everyone else has to kind of figure out, they're focusing on this or focusing on that, and right during the game, while still trying to keep up with the game. And sometimes, you're really in a bind. At the Wisconsin game, I was basically done with my column by the end of the third quarter. I said, LSU's going to lose. I knew people were going to freak out about LSU losing and what this meant. It's a young team, and then they started coming back. And it's like. And I knew it. You've seen this before under Miles, these late comebacks.
These comebacks under
Miles.
And
I was like, they are going to... So I started furiously writing, and I had to, basically in the fourth quarter, but in about 30 minutes, I had to write an entirely new column. And that was pretty intense, let me tell you. But I think it worked out okay. I salvaged like one paragraph from the first column I wrote.
You had a Saturday night deadline and then a Sunday night deadline with the Saints having a late game. So you were two nights in a row in different cities, right?
Yeah, I covered the LSU game, and then I flew out of here to Dallas. Fortunately, it was a quick straight shot to Dallas, and that was a night game. But I did that earlier this year when LSU played their home opener against Sam Houston, and then I went to Atlanta the next day for a noon game. Don't like to do those, but we do have to do those sometime. And this week, I'm going to Auburn. That's a night game, and then I'm going to get up early Sunday morning. We're going to stay in Montgomery, Alabama, and drive. Myself and another sports writer, we're going to drive about 4.5 hours back to New Orleans to catch the Saints-Tampa Bay game.
Oh, boy. So,
at noon
yeah.
Sunday.
Yeah.
So
when do you take time off? When do you take time off?
In the off-season, yeah.
In the off-season. Do you work 7 days a week?
Sometimes. This week is kind of a – I probably get off Thursday, but, maybe – I took off a little part of the day yesterday after getting back from Dallas. But it is work, and I don't know. Most people don't understand how the whole thing comes together because they're not familiar with this with our process.
I think people would be curious to hear a little bit about it. And we're listening to the Jim Inkster Show. This is Robert Scott with the Public Affairs Research Council sitting in for Jim. We're talking to Scott Rabelais, the Advocate sports columnist, and Scott, what's it like in the press box? I have actually worked a night as a sports reporter, although I really had no real responsibilities. But I've worked in the press box before and seen what it's like. First of all, people probably don't realize the reporters are not supposed to wear colors of their favorite team. You're supposed to be neutral, right?
Absolutely. And it's for either side.
You're not supposed to cheer either, right?
No. They make an announcement before the game. No cheering is allowed in the press box. And it does happen once in a while. There was a little bit of that in the Dallas press box this past night, this past Sunday, a little bit. But
They couldn't control themselves.
I'm an LSU grad. And I went to LSU. And Ross Dellinger, our main beat writer now for LSU football, went to Mississippi State. So, neither of us are allowed to cheer for our teams. They're playing, each other as they did a couple of weeks ago. So, no, it's pretty intense. And, of course, it's an open-air press box at LSU. So whatever crowd noise you have from what is now a 102,000-seat stadium, is just engulfing you, and you have to be able to shut that out and concentrate enough to be able to get your stories done. So we write on our laptops. We put our stories into an editing system that we're able to access from there. Then we call our copy desk, let them know that they're in. They put the headline on it, add any photos and stuff, put it all on a page electronically. They compose the each page of the sports section, the whole paper. On a screen, and they hit a button, it goes to our printing plant at Riga Road, where they turn it into a plate and put it on the press.
And all that has to happen according to a certain schedule, and you have to have your part done at a very particular deadline, or the whole system shuts down, and I don't get my paper on my front porch in the morning.
That's right. I mean, and a lot of times these late-night games, they are waiting for us to finish, before they can start those presses rolling.
Well, there's a lot of refreshments up in the press box, I notice. I mean, I say refreshments is an understatement. They bring in one buffet after another for the press during those games. Is that one of the fun parts of being in there? And how do you keep your weight down with all those groceries coming in?
That's not easy for me, especially. But you're there. You have to get there. Most writers get there a couple hours before the game, and the whole game is 4 hours long, and then you're there for a couple hours after. So you're there about 8 hours. So you don't have time to go to the concession stand, or certainly sometimes you have time maybe to go tailgating a little bit, visit some friends.
So you do tailgate on game days sometimes.
Well, maybe once a season I'll go out there. I haven't yet. So. I was kind of waiting for the weather to hopefully get cooler for a game or something. But they have to provide food for you in the press box. And same thing at the Superdome for a game and everywhere you go.
Well, I've been up there and have seen some pretty nice buffets. And you're a little surprised at how much is rolling out there. I don't know how you can keep it up. Listen, we want to know. What you think of the chances for LSU this year? This has been kind of an uneven season for them so far. How do you evaluate their chances this year of getting into a playoff system?
Well, I'm not Jimmy the Greek Snyder. I don't profess to be, but I did kind of expect this year with so many key losses from last year. You lost a 3,000-yard passing quarterback, 2,000-yard receivers, and a 1,000-yard rusher, a couple of key defensive players, especially a defensive tackle. I figured this is a year where they could play a lot of young players, and they could be up and down, and I think it's what we've seen so far this year. I don't really think LSU is a prime contender for the new college football playoff, which is, the top four teams at the end of the season are going to be in this playoff. One semifinal is going to be at the Sugar Bowl, and the championship game is going to be in Dallas. But I don't think really anything could happen still, and LSU's not out of it, but I don't really think that they're a true contender for that. But I think people should be a little patient this year. I think there's a lot of young players. They've recruited very well. They have a lot of very talented players, and I really think, especially now with Jennings moving over for Brandon Harris, if Harris can develop, as they hope he will, I think LSU has a chance to be an excellent team and a real national title contender in 2015 and 2016. But this year, people need to be a little patient. I mean, I think at this point, if they went 8-4, that would be a good season.
We hear a lot about the Heisman Trophy race, and it's become one of those sideshows during the football season that almost seems bigger than necessary to me. But Are you just an observer on the Heisman issue, or are you involved in some way in the whole Heisman scene?
No, I'm a Heisman voter.
Tell us about that. What does it mean to be a Heisman voter, and how do you go about that?
Well, I've been a voter since '97. I'm actually the state representative for the Heisman Trophy, which means when someone retires or moves, or in our business, unfortunately, gets laid off, I have to find a new voter to replace them. We have 19 media voters in Louisiana, plus Billy Cannon, who, of course, votes as a former Heisman winner.
How about that?
And I guess we throw in Tim Brando as well. He's a national voter, but we have 19 local people who vote. And you keep up during the season, and you try to watch as many games as you can and keep up with different players, how they're performing. At the end of the year, we used to get a ballot, but now it's all done electronically, and you vote for first, second, and third. And it is very little instruction. There's no finalists or anything like that. If there's some other awards that you vote on, they give you a list of finalists. Now with the Heisman, I could vote for LSU's tight end if I want to, or their backup tight end if I wanted to. And so you vote first, second, and third, and you hit the button, and, of course, they tally them up. There's a little over 900 voters, a little less than 1,000 voters nationwide. And so it's an honor. It's arguably the biggest individual award in sports, college or pro.
Right.
It is. And I take it very seriously and enjoy getting
to it. So when we hear you talk about the Heisman, it's more than just an observation. It might mean something. Real quick, your chances for the Saints. We're going to go in just a minute, Scott, but what do you think?
Anything's still possible. They've got to win Sunday against Tampa Bay. But they should focus on just trying to win their division, which is kind of mediocre this year.
Okay,
but,
got to run, then, Scott. Thanks a lot. The Scott Rabelais,
thank you.
With The Advocate. This is Robert Scott for Jim Inkster. See you next time.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.